This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الأوسط من إذاعة كيبو و صدای خبر میانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيبيا ولا بين ربوعنا خلوا ضحكة سهرات جوالي وطلوا حبابنا طلوا نسيبيا ولا بين ربوعنا خلوا فيات غنينا وعلى المياه لقينا على أقصى ما خلو من زهد الطير الشاد نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات نوال نحن حكايات
صلى صلى
طوب نحن حكايات في بال منا نغمات نوال لما المسمات لحلاله بين الغابات بلاد لما المسمات لحلال بين الغابات بلاد النخبات
با تو با در کنارت تنها تر از همیشه برو دیگه دروغا باور من نمیشه باور من نمیشه من خوشید صداقت تو شمع بی فروغی کاش از اول میدیدم دروغی تو دروغی دروغی تو دروغی
من با تو بربست شدم گریه ی آهست شدم برو دروغی شناختم از دروغات خست شدم من با تو بربست شدم یا آهسته شدم برو که خوب شناختمه از دروغات خسته شدم از دروغات خسته شدم
من قشنگی پروانه های رنگی دنیای تو سیاهی تو محکوم نیرنگی تو محکوم نیرنگی
من با تو بربست شدم گریه ی آهست شدم برو که خوب شناختم از دروغات خست شدم من با تو بربست شدم گریه ی آهست شدم برو که خوب شناختم از دروغات خست شدم
گریه ی آهسته شدم برو که خوب شناختمت از دروغات خسته شدم من با تو بربسته شدم گریه ی آهسته شدم برو که خوب شناختمت از دروغات خسته شدم من با تو بربسته شدم گریه ی آهسته شدم برو که خوب شناختمت از دروغات خسته شدم
Good evening. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is Gudarz Ektidari, your host tonight. I'm, as usual, we're having a very excellent program for tonight, and I have a guest that we will be discussing some issues, burning issues related to Middle East and especially to U.S.-Iran relations and the concept of how United States is approaching that country and how things are being drawn on the table pretty much the same way as it was a few years back before invasion of Iraq. I have Professor William Beeman. He is the professor of anthropology and director of Middle East Studies at Brown University, currently visiting professor of cultural and social anthropology at Stanford University. Dr. Beeman is a writer for the forthcoming book, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. Welcome to the program, Dr. Beeman.
Thank you very much. I'm so pleased to be with you.
Thank you. This is actually the second time I have Dr. Beeman on my show. Last time was right after the Iraqi invasion, and the kind of what was happening at that time was there were lots of publicity given to so-called Iranian opposition groups, major part of it the monarchists and the loyalists to the former regime of Iran. And Dr. Beeman had investigated basically the relation between those groups and how they were trying to become a new Chalabis of Iran. Now, today, I start with the latest news that came from London, and Tony Blair, Prime Minister Blair, has basically warned Iran not to take any position back from what the Treaty of November 15 of 2004 said, that Iran would dismantle or stop any nuclear activities in Iran. Dr. Beeman, your comment on that?
It's very important that people actually read that treaty, because the way that it has been characterized has been completely inaccurate. And in fact, Iran is right now adhering strictly to the terms of that treaty. First of all, the Iran promised unequivocally in the treaty that they would not develop nuclear weapons. There's a clause in the treaty that makes it extremely clear. That Iran pledges not to use their nuclear technology to develop any weapons whatsoever. Second of all, Iran has voluntarily agreed to halt its nuclear enrichment activities as a means of establishing their bona fides. The treaty does not call for Iran to dismantle anything, and it's been stated by people in the United States State Department that Iran is in violation of this treaty because they haven't started to dismantle their nuclear energy program. But that was never called for in the treaty. And what is happening now in Iran is in complete accord and with the provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. What is really ironic about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is that the United States is in violation of the treaty. Another provision of the treaty calls for the United States to reduce its nuclear arsenal, and the United States has not done that, and in fact does not plan to do that. And so the very curious thing is that the United States and its allies, especially Great Britain, are accusing Iran of being treaty violators when it is in fact the United States that is a treaty violator in this case.
I guess in your opinion, Ed, that you wrote just this week, you are kind of putting in a list the reasons why U.S. is kind of trying, has a hostile approach to Iran. And one of them, obviously, is weapons of mass destruction. But also, you mentioned two other items that are supposedly the reasons why U.S. is not approaching Iran any friendlier. Could you just elaborate on those two other items that you mentioned in that article?
Actually, there are three others. And okay. The first is that the United States has routinely, since the 1980s, said that Iran is the greatest state supporter of terrorism in the world. The second has to do with the treatment of women in Iran, and the third has to do with the treatment of minority groups within Iran. Curiously, the United States has never accused Iran of being in violation of human rights. And actually, that particular charge, if the United States were to make it, would be the one that I think would have the most salience, the most importance. But the United States has not made that charge against Iran, and maybe we can talk about why we have not done that. But it's the first one, the state support of terrorism, that is the one that is usually unquestioned. And in fact, the single group that Iran has been demonstrated to have supported is Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And the Iranian support of Hezbollah goes back to the early 1980s, right after the Iranian Revolution. What is interesting about that today is that Hezbollah has completely changed its nature over the years. And after 25, 26 years, it is not the same organization that it was at the very beginning. And Iran has, in fact, withdrawn all of its military support from southern Lebanon and from Hezbollah at this time. Hezbollah has no further need of Iran, and Iranian support to Hezbollah is currently totally irrelevant.
But
the other charges that have been made about the support of terrorism are completely unsubstantiated. They are simply charges and without any evidence whatsoever.
But, I mean, I guess the matter of Hezbollah is in the context of Lebanon and kind of like a peace between Israel and Palestinians. Isn't that the case? And how Iran plays a role in that situation? And is it in any ways for peace or not?
Iran was interested in supporting Hezbollah because the Shia community in southern Iraq was being attacked by Israel when Israel attacked Palestinians that were making incursions into northern Israel. And the Shia were not being protected by their own government, and they were being, again, ruthlessly attacked. And the Hezbollah was formed in order to form a defense barrier against the Israeli attacks that were taking place. And Iran, right after the revolution, was interested in supporting the Shia community, and also they were interested in, of course, the revolutionary ideology that actually caused the revolution to take place and the overthrow of the Shah. So part of their interest in Hezbollah was to protect this community, and the other part was to promulgate the revolutionary ideology of the original revolution in Iran. So yes, the Shia were engaged in the first instance in self-defense, and later on they became a very successful military operation with the help of Iran, admittedly, and with the help of Syria. And now they've transformed themselves into a political party. They have 14 representatives in the Lebanese parliament, and they run schools, orphanages, and hospitals, and are now probably the most powerful and organized political group in Lebanon. If things continue in Lebanon the way they will, they probably will turn out to be the dominant political force there.
So, in other words, the whole concept of Iranian supporting terrorism goes just into that context of Lebanon and what Hezbollah or Hamas is doing in
yes.
related to Israel. It doesn't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda or any other operation.
Not at all. And in fact, the United States has tried very hard to show that Iran has some connection to Al-Qaeda or to the Taliban. Anybody who works in the Middle East knows that this is ridiculous. And the reason is because the government of Iran is a Shia government, and the Taliban are ruthlessly fundamentalist Sunnis, as are the members of Al-Qaeda. The Wahhabi philosophy that is the backing for Al-Qaeda considers Shiism to be blasphemy. It considers it to be a completely not Islamic form of religion. And so the government of Iran is not interested at all in doing anything with Al-Qaeda. They've had no common philosophy with these people at all. So these are continual charges on the part of the United States to try to make the charge of Iran's general support for terrorism stick. But really and truly, the only absolutely demonstrable case is the case of Hezbollah.
And how about in Iraq? Is there any reason why Iran should be supporting any of these insurgencies in Iraq? Why the Shia government is now more in power?
There's no need to, actually. The Shia in Iraq are doing just fine, just entirely by themselves. And the as far as anyone can tell, even by the U.S. intelligence reports, the incursions that are taking place in Iraq are not taking place on the part of Shia. They're Sunni, and there may be some external forces that are in fact linked to Al Qaeda, but these are not forces that are supported by Iran. The Shia community is the dominant community in Iraq. They have excellent leadership under the philosophical leadership of Ayatollah al-Sistani, and they've managed their affairs very well. So there's simply no reason at all for Iran to have any incursion whatsoever. What actually is interesting is that if Iraq stabilizes and the government of Iraq becomes established with a Shia dominance, it's going to be not Iran that's going to influence Iraq. It's going to be Iraq that's going to influence Iran, because the most revered scholars in the Shia world are actually in Najaf. Najaf was traditionally the principal seat of Shia scholarship and Shia jurisprudence. And so if this actually comes about and if Iraq stabilizes, the world of Shiism is going to look to Najaf for leadership and not to Tehran.
The other, issue that you noted in your article was human rights situation in Iran and rights of women. Can you elaborate on that? And what is your what's your opinion? What direction is that moving forward?
The situation with women in Iran is quite amazing. I know that the stereotype in the United States is one of that women in Iran are somehow terrorized and oppressed by male hegemonistic forces, and they're women who are forced to run around covered in black cloth all the time as second-class citizens. One recent book by Jerome Corsi called Atomic Iran, which I, in fact, do not recommend to your listeners because it's complete nonsense from beginning to end. But it calls women little more than animals that are herded around by their male slave drivers. I mean, that is so far from the truth that I hardly even know where to start.
Is it the writer
Iran,
of
since the revolution have in fact made fantastic progress? Right now, 60% of university enrollees are women, and women succeed in university entrance exams 75% to 25%. That is, 25% of the males succeed, 75% of the women succeed. And this is including fields like medicine and engineering. So we have a large coterie of women that are becoming engineers. They have they've managed to find careers in every profession, including law, medicine, and also business, where many of them have independent businesses. Now the problem, the general problem of unemployment in Iran is great, and so women also have an unemployment problem, but they're extremely well trained. Literacy has increased for women from in the 1980s right up to the revolution. Literacy for women was at about 30%. Now it's above 90% for both men and women. And as a result, the fertility rate has dropped tremendously. Every woman in Iran used to have an average of 6 children in the 1980s. Now the number has dropped to 2, which is a very wonderful thing for the economy and for family economy as well. 75% of people in Iran are using birth control methods. So it is there's been great advances in women's health and great advances in women's education and in also their employment. Where women are lacking still is in the legal area. There are still laws that are based on Sharia law that have not been modified, that do not favor women. And, of course, great women lawyers like Shirin Ebadi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, has a huge group of women and male lawyers that are working hard to try to modify those laws.
But I guess we cannot argue that still there are lots of things that needs to be done in order to provide a free and democratic situation in Iran, isn't that?
That's absolutely true, of course. You know, and Iran is still a work in progress. But what is most important, I think, for everybody to understand is that this is not a society anymore that is under the dictatorship of a theocratic oligarchy in the government. The reform movement, which started in the late 1990s, was disappointing for many Iranians. They wanted greater civil freedoms and much more independent freedoms for individuals. And the Iranian parliament that was elected during this reform period was, in fact, extremely progressive. The difficulty is in the Iranian constitution, which interposes a council of guardians over all legislation, and they vetoed one piece of legislation after another that was very progressive in terms of human rights. So the impetus on the part of Iranian citizens is there. At some point, there's no question that the Iranian constitution is going to need to be changed. My feeling is that this is going to happen probably within the next 10 years. And the reason that I believe this is because of the demographics in Iran. Right now, the population of Iran is 75% under the age of 25. But the majority of this young population has not yet reached voting age. In the next 5 years, we'll see the majority of the voting population will be people who never knew the revolution, who never knew Ayatollah Khomeini, and who are not disposed to being particularly religious in their outlook on life. These are people who are very positively disposed to the United States. They're computer literate. They surf the internet. They travel widely, and they're very well educated. And I believe that we'll see within 5 to 10 years a really an amazing transformation in Iran, because the voting population will simply demand that the changes that were started during the reform movement be actually implemented. And I predict that the Iranian constitution at that point will be modified.
You mentioned the reform movement and the period that it started in around 1997. How do you perceive this, the difference between administration in the United States and how they approached the Iranian question, and what kind of impact that had on advancement of reform and now on basically taking power by more conservative forces? Is there any relation between how, do you see any relation, do you see any relation between like Bush administration's approach to the Middle East and what is happening right now in Iran and kind of turning back into more conservative mode?
Certainly. I should point out to you that the United States has been used to demonizing Iran for domestic political purposes in the United States ever since the Iranian Revolution. And this means that it was both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations that used Iran as a convenient scapegoat whenever the United States wanted to look like it was getting tough in the world. United States was very slow to recognize the reform movement in Iran and very slow to react. There were some people in the Clinton administration, for instance, Madeleine Albright, who was interested in trying to foster better relations with Iran. She saw that opportunity. But by that time, the Republicans in the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives had achieved a majority. And by the time the Clinton administration was ready to respond to the reform movement in Iran, it was actually too late politically in the United States. And any Democrat, or Democratic president, or Democratic administration that then would have made an overture to Iran would have been completely criticized by the Republican majority in the Congress and the House of Representatives. We have right now any number of people within the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives that are actively seeking to overthrow the current government of Iran, and they have, in fact, a bill before the House Bill 228, and Senate Bill 333 that call for a renewal of the economic sanctions against Iran and also for support of opposition groups to the Iranian government. And by opposition groups, they mean the Mujahideen-e Khalq, the MEK, a group that was resident in Iraq during the entire time that Saddam Hussein was in power and who had opposed the government of Iran and who have many supporters among U.S. legislators here in the United States.
Do you know why this relation exists between the MEK and these members of the parliament and the Congress?
There are two reasons. First of all, the MEK has been extremely successful at publicizing itself as a freedom fighting group. They actually were people forget that the MEK actually attacked American diplomats during the Pahlavi period. So they have American blood on their hands. And they're still classified as a terrorist group by the U.S. government. However, the certain neoconservative commentators have tried to get the U.S. government to reclassify themselves. Namely, Daniel Pipes and Patrick Clawson wrote an editorial that was widely circulated in 2003, May 20th, actually, 2003, that called for a reclassification of the MEK, saying that they could be very useful to the United States in overthrowing the government of Iran. The second reason that that people are on their side is that it was the MEK that disclosed the nuclear energy development operations that were taking place in Iran and some of the sites that Iran had not disclosed to the rest of the world. And so they provided that intelligence to the United States. They also provided more intelligence that turned out to be completely inaccurate. But they provided some initial intelligence that the Bush administration is quite grateful for. It is perhaps important for some of your listeners who may not be familiar with Iran to know that the Iranian population inside Iran really hate them. They were actually fighting against Iran during the Iran-Iraq War, and they, of course, were supported by Saddam Hussein during this entire time. So they're not supported within Iran, and the idea that they could somehow formulate a new government or an alternative to the present regime is, I think, politically not feasible.